Greetings, constant traveler. Stay tuned at the end of today's road journey for a little airborne bonus. It's a surprise, but I should warn you, it's not for the nervous flyer. You're in the middle of nowhere, with the day fading to a pale band on the horizon. From the descending dark, a bus pulls up, brightly lit inside, but with no name, no destination. The door shuttles open before you. There is no driver. Do you climb aboard? Of course you do. It's why you're here. Welcome to the Gray Line. Today's journey takes us to Oxford, England, where, sadly, we won't be touring the historical university or famed botanical gardens. Instead, we'll be stopping over at an otherwise anonymous stretch of highway, where morning rain has reduced both visibility and, in a few moments, suspension of disbelief. This will come as a particular shock to your fellow traveler, that dapper young husband and father of one, squinting anxiously through the rain-streaked window. His name is Joel Dunham, and Joel's about to learn that existential questions don't always wait to be asked. Sometimes they come hurtling out of the darkness like a sleepy lorry driver drifting across the center line, 11 miles out of Oxford, but directly en route to the Gray Line.
The sound of metal on metal was surprisingly anticlimactic. Joel tried to steer, but the wheel simply spun, batting his hands away as the minivan turned a lazy pirouette, sliding on wet pavement. Dark trees swept past the windscreen, then the guardrail, then the burgundy flank of the lorry that had hit them, turning its own step in the dance, its headlights blazing across streaks of rain. Angela's scream sounded like something underwater, murky and alien in the slow-motion suspense. Then, with a slam and a confetti burst of shattered glass, the van struck the guardrail, flipped over it, rolled and bounced off a tree. Weeds and cattails burst in through the broken windscreen, swatted at Joel's face, ripped off his glasses.
"Hill!"
he heard himself scream even as the van rocked back onto its side.
"Hill! Hill, are you okay?"
The rearview mirror was gone with the windscreen. The seatbelt held him captive, locked taut and merciless. He flailed behind him with his right hand, groping for the car seat, for Hillary's little shoes or hands.
"Joel!"
a voice called out to him. He barely heard it.
"Joel, stop! Stop! Don't look!"
But he couldn't stop. He struggled in his seat, scrabbled at the seatbelt. It was too tight. His hair was full of pebbles of glass.
"Joel!"
Angela said again, louder. The tone of her voice, both commanding and strangely calm, broke through his panic. He looked at her, blinked at her. Even without his glasses, he sensed a strangely composed finality in her demeanor, a sort of reluctant knowing.
"Don't look, Joel,"
she said, half-turned in her own seat, her hair mussed, a trickle of blood across the knuckles on her right hand.
"Hillary didn't make it. I'm sorry, but listen to me. She's going to be okay. It's all going to be okay."
30 minutes later, they were sitting in the back of an ambulance looking down at the small, motionless figure under a white sheet. Rain dripped from the open rear doors of the ambulance, sizzled faintly along the A40, rose up in misty, swooshing clouds behind the occasional traffic. The lorry lay beached in the central reservation, tilted precariously onto its side, its hazard lights blinking stupidly, casting orange glints onto the morning rain.
"Why aren't we doing something to save Hill?"
Joel asked, looking up as if from a waking nightmare.
"Why are we just sitting here?
Joel.
What is this? Why aren't we rushing to the hospital?"
"We're not affiliated with a hospital, Mr. Dunham," said one of the two medics.
He hunkered just inside the open door, his face blank and calm, his aqua-green uniform spotless.
"At least not in the usual sense. We are from Apotheosis.
Joel blinked at the man as if he'd spoken to him in an alien language.
What's Apotheosis? Can you save Hillary? Why aren't you helping her?
Joel.
Angela said to him, almost apologetically.
I need you to understand something. This isn't our first accident.
She was studying his face, eerily calm. Joel was holding their daughter's cold hand. It was the only part of her body visible beneath the sheet. Angela tilted her head, forced him to look at her.
Try to remember. The holiday in Snowdonia. Driving home through the night.
He nodded vaguely. His voice was hoarse, cracking.
Of course I remember. Hill was just a baby. We met your parents there to show her off. But on the way back, the drunk university kid. We were so lucky then. So lucky.
His voice thickened. His eyes blurred with tears.
We weren't, though, were we?
Angela said gravely, putting her hand gently on his elbow, steadying him.
We weren't lucky, Joel. What you remember about that accident, it isn't the truth. You chose the blissful ignorance option. You said you couldn't bear knowing what really happened, having those memories in your head. Memories of Hillary. Well, like this.
She sighed. The sound was both brisk and businesslike. She glanced out at the pattering rain, at the fog and the damp fields that lined the road. When she looked back again, her eyes were pained.
It was worse then. I didn't blame you for wanting to forget. I may take the option myself this time.
Joel shook his head at her, uncomprehending and frantic.
What are you talking about? Our daughter's dead. My sweet Hill is dead.
She's been dead since she was 11 months old, Joel.
Angela said calmly, bracingly, squeezing his arm again.
I'm so sorry to have to say that to you, to reawaken that memory. I hoped it was over forever and we could both move on. She died just after Christmas 2 years ago.
Joel was speechless. Tormented and confused, he simply shook his head, dumbstruck. Angela nodded sadly, then turned to the open ambulance doors. The other medic had returned from the lorry. She was young and trim, probably Middle Eastern, with a kind, solemn face. She stood in the drizzling rain at a respectful distance, but approached when she saw Angela's look. She met Joel's eyes and said,
I'm sorry, Mr. Dunham. The Hillary you've known for the last 2 years is a simulation, a kind of cybernetic clone, an artificial intelligence augmented with your daughter's cerebral profile. She's part of an experimental program designed to help Apotheosis's biointelligence hybrid technology.
Joel frowned, gawked, glanced from the young woman to Angela, then to the figure beneath the sheet.
What are you telling me?
Even through his tears, he barked a desperate, disbelieving laugh.
My daughter is some kind of...
He shook his head, biting back the word, stifling a sob.
The simulations are sturdy but sensitive,
the woman explained carefully.
Absolutely lifelike in every way. They grow, learn, and mature. They don't know they aren't human. But while they're less prone to physical damage than biological humans, their neural networks are very delicate. In moments of trauma, they auto-save their data and suspend their systems.
Joel stared at the woman as she spoke, watched her mouth form the words, but couldn't bring himself to comprehend them.
We were chosen from a lottery of candidates,
Angela explained patiently.
They said we could have our Hillary back if we agreed to sign a lifetime non-disclosure agreement. They could make it easy for us, shield us from the truth if we wanted. They said they could make us forget everything that happened. But it wasn't a good idea for both of us to do it. The forgetting effect is permanent, they said. As long as there's nothing to revive the memories, any detailed reminders of the accident could cause memory leaks and even psychological problems. They said that one of us should remember what happened, what Hillary really is, so we can guard the other one from accidental reminders. We agreed together that you should be the one to forget.
Joel swallowed past what felt like a ball of worms in his throat. In a strained voice, he asked,
Does all of this mean that this version of Hillary isn't...
The female technician traded places with her male counterpart, climbing up into the ambulance before answering.
The Hillary you've known for the past 27 months isn't dead. She's just temporarily offline until we can recalibrate her neural network and run a series of personality and behavioral diagnostics. We'll also repair or replace her bioshell. It may take a few days, but she'll be fine. She won't remember that any of this ever happened.
But...
Joel shook his head, his voice strained, shrill.
But she's not really real, is she?
Bracingly, Angela said,
She's as real as we believe her to be, Joel. She'll grow up, she'll experience everything our own Hillary never could have. What was the alternative? What other choice was there?
He merely shook his head, unable to answer. Angela's face softened, turned sympathetic but resolved.
Watch this,
she said quietly.
It will help.
The female technician had produced a sort of wand from a compartment. It looked like the paddles airport security used to scan passengers for weapons, only sterile white instead of black. Respectfully, the woman pulled back the sheet from Hillary's upper body. Joel hitched a gasp, held his breath, couldn't tear his eyes away from the toddler's bloody face and hair. Her eyes were closed as if in sleep. The technician moved the wand over the girl's upper chest, seemed to locate a specific area just below Hillary's throat, and a soft chime sounded. Hillary's eyes opened. Joel nearly leapt in his seat. Angela held him back, whispered in his ear,
Just watch, honey, just watch.
Hillary?
The technician asked clearly.
Can you hear me? Blink once for yes.
Hillary blinked once. Her eyes stared up at a corner of the low ceiling, open and beautiful, but clearly unseeing. Shrilly, Joel whispered,
What's wrong with her?
Hillary, please run primary syscheck protocol and report any memory net failures. Blink once for failures, twice for none.
Hillary's eyes ticked minutely for several seconds. Then she blinked twice. Angela exhaled harshly, slumped with relief.
Oh, thank God.
The technician looked at Joel, then Angela, her eyes steady.
We'll need to take Hillary back to Apotheosis to recalibrate her, but we don't anticipate any lasting effects. You're welcome to stay in our family suite until she is ready to go back home with you, if that works with your schedule.
Joel's mind was still reeling with disbelief.
If that works with our schedule? I just found out that my daughter is some kind of a robot. How am I supposed to just accept this? How can I ever forget that when I get her back, my daughter?
He turned back to Angela, his face contorted, pleading.
Our daughter has been dead for 2 years. We didn't even mourn her. We've been living in the delusion. Angela, how could you let this happen? How could you live with this kind of lie?
Angela drew a long, deep breath and shook her head slowly, shuddering as she let it out. Regret was like a storm cloud in her eyes.
They warned me you wouldn't be able to absorb it. They said there'd be psychological problems if you ever found out, but I hoped it wouldn't have to be like this. Joel, I'm sorry.
Joel threw up his hands, shook his head in blind consternation.
I should hope so. We just celebrated our third birthday, Angela. What was it, 3 months ago that we had her party? My parents, everyone we know, they brought her presents. You made her strawberry cake and she ate it. She ate it. But she's not real, Angela. How could you? How could you pretend?
I couldn't live without the two of you.
Angela burst out, her own face crumpling into an alarming mask of woe. Tears suddenly coursed down her cheeks. Joel was caught between wanting to comfort her, to cling to her like a drowning man to a life raft, and being repulsed by her blithe, willing delusion. But then her words replayed in his head, and he froze. I couldn't live without the two of you. Angela saw the dawning comprehension on his face.
Try to imagine what it was like for me, Joel.
She pleaded with him, grabbing both of his shoulders, forcing him to look at her.
I was stuck in the car with both of you. Both of you dead. I screamed until my voice broke, and do you know what the drunk kid did? He stumbled out of his car with a few bruises and a broken nose and puked on the centre line and wandered off into the dark, singing and laughing. I was left alone with my dead baby and my dead husband until the fireman cut me out of the car with the jaws of life. I'm sorry, Joe. I broke. I couldn't face it. You could have, if you'd have been the one to live, but I couldn't. I couldn't. I'm sorry.
Icy numbness fell over Joel, coursed from his head to the soles of his feet as if he'd been doused with cold acid. He stared at his wife, absorbed her horror, her tears, her pleading for forgiveness, but could comprehend none of it. He studied her face dully, like a man trying to read an alien map. With sudden, preternatural instinct, he broke from his wife's haunted eyes and turned slowly to the female technician. "They don't know they aren't human," she had said. She was holding the white paddle near his chest. It gave a low chime. Every muscle in Joel's body arrested, locked him into perfect stasis. He stopped breathing. His eyes stared at the woman, unblinking.
"Joel?"
she asked calmly. A voice tolled inside his head like a bell.
"Can you hear me?"
He felt himself blink once. Angela sobbed. She grabbed his suddenly stiff hand, raised it and placed it against her wet cheeks.
"I'll get him back, won't I? I'll get both of them back."
"Of course you will,"
the woman soothed. Then,
"Joel, please run cis routine blissful ignorance and purge all memory stores for the last hour. Perform a full backup reboot, then blink yes when complete. Blink yes when complete."
1 minute later, something blinked.
Joel Dunham, a dead man's memories brought back to life by science, but forever subject to the whim and mercy of the end-user license agreement. Of course, this doesn't apply to you, dear traveler. If you were an archived personality matrix embedded in an advanced AI clone, you'd know it, wouldn't you? Alas, perhaps that's a question best left unpondered as we conclude tonight's journey. Please collect your luggage, should you have any, and mind the closing doors. And as always, remember, not every journey ends so pleasantly. The next time you travel with us, you may find yourself lost forever. Just one more tale told along the forgotten backroads of the Grey Line. The Grey Line is written and produced by me, G. Norman Lippert. Apotheosis featured the voice talents of Jess Sargent, narration, Jeannie Lynn as the Apotheosis technician, and debuting Alana Harris as Angela Dunham. If you are enjoying The Grey Line, please hit subscribe and take a moment to leave a review on your favorite podcast listening app. Nominate your town for an upcoming destination, if you dare. And as always, tell all your friends and a few choice enemies. Finally, we have a small bonus journey for you today. The following is an excerpt from my novel, Red Eye, featuring the voice talents of Steve White and Jeannie Lynn. We join our tale in Oakland International Airport, 1981, as our fellow traveler, Henry Donner, embarks on a midnight flight, manned by a crew of mysteriously perfect stewardesses, and with an ultimate destination not mentioned on the boarding pass, and well past the international dateline of the Grey Line.
Mr. Babinski was just climbing the air stairs toward the glow of the plane's open door. The blonde stewardess was framed there in silhouette, watching. Donner heard her voice jingle distantly as she greeted the old man, ushering him in. Then she turned to look down at Donner as he clanked up the narrow metal stairs, his briefcase bouncing awkwardly against his knee.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Donner.
Her voice was high, nearly shrill and perky almost to the point of caricature. This was offset, however, by the sincere blue eyes she greeted him with and the soft waves of golden hair that caught the light like a halo. Donner nodded and smiled. He couldn't help himself. Her eyes glimmered warmly, and yet there was something in them that seemed wrong somehow, off-kilter, like perhaps she was idly considering how much force it would take to strip his face to ribbons with her immaculate long fingernails. He shook himself, surprised at the thought, but she didn't blink. Her wide smile didn't falter. A moment later, he was walking along the brightly lit center aisle of the plane, absorbing its low hums and throbs, its impersonal closeness. Less than a quarter of the first class seats were filled. The remainder of the plane was virtually deserted, looking like nothing more than what it was, a long, empty cylinder studded with orange seats. He located row 2, seat B, paused to ram his briefcase up into the overhead compartment, and then plopped down to wait. More passengers were boarding behind him, forming a steady, shuffling line, occasionally blocking traffic to manhandle their own luggage into the overhead. The line of faces was strangely quiet, but for the dull thump of luggage and the soft tramp of feet on the nappy carpet. The young mother passed Donner without a glance, lugging a limp Jordache bag behind her, her infant son still on her shoulder. The boy was stirring, muttering disconsolately. The businessman in the three-piece suit was seated in first class, only a few rows ahead of Donner, along the opposite aisle. He was leaning forward in his much larger and softer seat, hands clutched on his knees, his head hunkered between his shoulders. Maybe he wasn't a very good flyer, or maybe he'd reached that stage of intoxication where what had gone down was now deciding to reverse course. His shoulders rose and fell rhythmically, as if he was panting, or perhaps sobbing to himself. Donner looked away, embarrassed. He wondered briefly about the stewardesses. Two of them had called him by name. How had they known? The redhead hadn't even looked down at his ticket. He was sure of it. Her emerald eyes had stayed locked on him, as if studying him, measuring him somehow. He'd made a fool of himself in front of her, being momentarily overcome by that stupid, childish urge to run away, like the woman in the white pantsuit, or like the mom of the college guy who had apparently talked her son out of boarding. Donner had heard stories about such things, about people having dreams or visions of impending danger and turning back at the last minute. It had happened with the Titanic, hadn't it? Or was that just a legend? Some rich woman had gotten a bad feeling about the ship and talked her husband out of getting aboard, or something like that. Good for her if it was true. But it was probably just the law of averages. Probably a certain percentage of people got bad juju before any trip and chickened out. And then, on the rare occasion that there actually was a disaster, those people made headlines, at least in the tabloids, because somehow they had known. It was just superstition, of course. Nonsense meant for people who tended to believe in Bigfoot and alien abductions. But the stewardesses had known his name. They had known without so much as looking at his ticket. He rolled his eyes and shook his head. There were flight rosters, weren't there? Passenger manifests, that kind of thing. The crew didn't need the tickets to know who was getting on board. Of course not. Some deeper part of his mind rejected this logic, but he shut it off with a force of will. Instead, he looked around, trying to gauge how soon the plane might take off. There were still people finding their seats, but the influx of passengers had tapered. All three stewardesses were aboard now. A dull thump sounded from the front of the plane, accompanied by a subtle change in the interior pressure. The main door had been closed. Donner peered sideways, past the empty seat next to him, and out the oval window. The air stairs were backing away from the plane, fading into the night. Donner was glad to see it. He craned to look back over the plane's interior. Despite the stewardess's claim that the flight was overbooked, At least half of the seats appeared to be empty. Passengers took advantage of this to separate themselves, settling in and clicking their seatbelts. A few newspapers were shook out, a few cigarettes smoked, and headphones unwrapped for the in-flight movie. But for the most part, the passengers simply sat, blank-eyed, zoned out, not quite bored, but expectant somehow, eager. Donner felt it as well. He glanced ahead, willing the engines to cycle up, the runway lights to begin to sweep past the window. The blonde stewardess, her name is Lilith, Donner remembered, having glimpsed it on the name tag affixed above her left breast, stepped lightly through first class and stopped near the curtain that separated the sections. Still smiling her sincere, somewhat disconcerting smile, she hooked a beige telephone from a rack on the bulkhead, nearly identical to the one behind the gate counter, and spoke into it.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she announced,
her voice ringing throughout the cabin, shrill but flattened by amplification.
"The captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please stow your carry-on luggage in an overhead bin. Take your seat and fasten your seatbelt. And also make sure your seat back and folding trays are in their full upright position."
She paused and allowed her blue gaze to roam over the passengers, as if marking each and every one with her smile. Her eyes crinkled warmly at the corners. Taking a light breath, she went on.
"If you are seated next to an emergency exit, please read carefully the special instructions card located by your seat. If you do not wish to perform the functions described in the event of an emergency, please ask a stewardess to reseat you. If you are flying to New York for a job interview, please be aware that this is an endeavor most likely to end in disappointment. No one will hire you. You're damaged and useless. You're a self-fulfilling prophecy of incompetence."
Donner blinked as the blonde's amplified voice poured into his mind, setting off silent alarms of inexplicable consternation. He couldn't be hearing her right, could he? Was she talking about him specifically? He realized he was still looking up at her with the generic blankness of someone who's heard the same spiel 100 times. But this was no longer the same spiel. She was looking back at him now, still with the phone held delicately to her head, her blue eyes wide and musing, still smiling as she spoke.
"Who do you think you're fooling anyway?"
she said, employing the same banal reciting voice.
"You didn't make any programming mistakes. You knew exactly what you were doing. You were sabotaging the infrastructure. You did it on purpose, because you hate them all. Frank Liston, Hal Oberforth, Jenny Duchesne, all of them. You hate them because they believe you killed your wife. But mostly you hate yourself, Mr. Donner. You sabotaged yourself because you know they're right."
Donner's face felt welded in place, stunned with disbelief. On some clinical level, he knew he should be mortified that she was talking about him, horrified that everyone was hearing these terrible allegations. But the only thought that occupied his head, clanging repeatedly like a gong, was a single sentence. How could she know? No one knew. Even he hadn't known. Not really. Not until this very moment. But as the beautiful blonde stewardess's lips formed the words, the truth of them hit him like punches, pushing him into his seat, making the blood fall from his stupidly frozen face.
"To fasten your seatbelt,"
she went on, glancing back over the cabin,
"insert the metal fitting into the buckle, adjust to fit snugly with the loose end of the strap, and simply lift the buckle release to unfasten. Your seatbelt should always be worn low and tight across your lap."
The vapor lock on Donner's face finally broke. He swallowed hard and felt a sheen of sweat burst out on his forehead and cheeks. His eyes were like hot marbles jammed into his head. Lilith, the stewardess, hung up the public address telephone, turned without a second look, and sashayed daintily back through first class to rejoin her companions. Carefully, Donner looked around, peering out of the corners of his eyes. No one else seemed at all perturbed by the pre-flight announcement. The rest of the passengers were settling in, appearing just as bored yet strangely eager as ever. No one looked at him or even glanced in his direction. he'd imagined it. Was it possible? Could his mind truly have conjured such a vivid, unmistakable, guilt-fueled hallucination? Maybe. Especially if it was true, and he knew now that it was. He hadn't screwed up. He had deliberately sabotaged the Tandem Technologies communication infrastructure, if on a barely conscious level. Not only because he did indeed hate Liston, along with Oberforth and Jenny Duchesne, hated them for the condescending sympathy that masked their accusing stares, but because he needed a way out, an escape, a plan B. He had sabotaged himself because he knew that the guilt he saw in his co-workers' eyes was really the guilt he felt in his own heart, late at night, lying in bed next to Laurie's empty space, with her clean ashtray still presiding on her bedside table, and nothing but the tick of the clock for company. Lilith, the stewardess, might know his name from a passenger manifest, but there was no way she could know about these long, sleepless nights, sharing the bed with nothing but guilt. That was crazy. Was he crazy? He considered it. It wasn't impossible. Stress could do terrible things to a person's mind. And he had endured quite an overload of stress over the past 5 months, hadn't he? He drew a long, deep sigh, letting it out in a shaky exhale and settling deeper into his seat. Weakly, he let his head drift to the side, directing his gaze to the window. The plane had finished its taxi and lined up for takeoff. Slowly, the runway lights began to shuttle past, growing steadily quicker, like beads on a string. The whine of the engines grew both louder and deeper, settling into a throbbing roar, pushing the plane steadily forward. A faint ding rang through the cabin, and a sign lit overhead. "No smoking," glowed the words above the red circle slash. "No fumar" below. Donner stared at the sign, not needing his 2 years of high school Spanish to understand the bottom part. "¿Dónde están los sanitarios?" His mind offered up the phrase inanely, just a piece of random flotsam, much like Grandma's Bible verse, along with the English translation, "Where is the toilet?" He turned back to the window, not really seeing it. The floor thrummed beneath his feet, as if he could feel every contour of the runway as it ran away beneath them, retracting like a window shade, faster and faster until finally, gently, the airplane's nose tilted up. The thrum of the wheels diminished and then fell away completely, replaced with blissful smoothness as the plane lifted. The runway fell away, growing small and unimportant with surprising speed. Beyond it, the city of Oakland spread away in a sea of lights. The roads became amber grids dotted with glinting cars, slug-like buses, all crawling in and out of the streetlights. None of it mattered. It was too late to turn back now. None of it mattered. Even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light, Donner thought. And then, I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to go to space. A minute later, fitfully and restlessly, his face still sheened with nervous sweat, Donner slept.
This has been an excerpt of Red Eye. Find the complete story in print, ebook, or audio by searching G. Norman Lippert, Red Eye, at Amazon.com, or check the links in this episode's show notes.